The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think the White House counsel really does benefit enormously from an acceptance of his or her role and a process-mindedness that supports the counsel in doing his or her job. The White House counsel cannot operate in a White House in which there are endless factions quarreling with each other. Some may be aligned with the White House counsel, some may be suspicious of the White House counsel, and no predictable procedure for the raising and addressing of legal issues. Now, for all I know, that situation has changed since the chief of staff's position changed, since the person holding that office changed. But I can't imagine, from the client to the parent Wild West kind of character of the deliberative process that we understand to be the case in this current White House, I would imagine it'd be a very, very difficult job for the White House counsel to do.
I'm Vanessa Sauter, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 7th, 2017. Last month, Lawfare and Foreign Policy hosted an event on lawyering for the Trump presidency. Susan Hennessy spoke with former White House counsels Bob Bauer, who served in the Obama administration from 2010 to 2011, and A.B. Kolbehaus, who served in the Reagan administration from 1987 to 1989, in a lively discussion on providing legal support when your client is the president. They talked about the distinction between a president's personal counsel and White House counsel, the challenges of defending a president during an investigation, and the quotidian aspects of the role of the White House counsel. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 251, Defending the President.
I'll kick it right off because I think we're most interested in hearing what you gentlemen have to say. So the first is sort of when people, you know, ask you, what did you do? What is the job of the White House counsel? You know, how do you describe it? What's sort of your quick answer on that?
I was White House counsel a long time ago, but I think it's fair to say it was then and now you're the institutional counsel for the president and the office of the presidency. It's your job to defend and preserve the president's constitutional prerogatives. You're a quality control check. You review for both legality and consistency with the president's decisions, everything that he signs, approves, and says, and is issued in his name. As mentioned in my introduction, the White House counsel now, I believe it's fair to say, Bob, has primacy on judicial selection. Defending the White House and the president in the context of oversight investigations and special counsel investigations is also quite important.
Bob, do you have an additional?
No, that's right. I would have enjoyed my primacy on judicial selection if it hadn't been for the Congress. But I agree with everything that AB said. The one point I would add is about the difference between the White House counsel's institutional role and the very complicated business of representing a president who is a flesh and blood political actor elected to the office to pursue certain policies. So you are, on the one hand, representing the institution and trying to keep those interests very much in mind. At the same time, you're also representing this individual in the Oval Office who's been elected to carry out certain programs and who's obviously looking for you to enable him where the law allows to do that. So that's been an issue that's tripped up a number of White House counsels in the past.
So, AB, you sort of referenced this notion of being the White House counsel when there is ongoing investigations. That clearly is at the top of everyone's minds right now. How is the role of the White House counsel different sort of in that period of investigation you served during Iran-Contra versus sort of the ordinary, the day-to-day?
That's all I did for the first 9 months, frankly. I was White House counsel. I came in, all of you were still in grade school probably if you were born, but I came in as part of the Howard Baker rescue team. It was, we had an independent counsel and a joint congressional committee investigating the arms sales to Iran and the diversion of proceeds from those sales to the Nicaraguan Democratic Resistance. Pretty complicated transaction. You're basically in a damage mitigation role. If you think about it, I think Ronald Reagan, in terms of domestic politics, lost a year of his presidency because of Iran-Contra. We got almost nothing done domestically. We had vetoes overridden. We couldn't get 34 Republican senators to vote with us on veto overrides. One could argue that Bob Bork's not being confirmed to the Supreme Court was partly as a result of the fact that Ronald Reagan's approval ratings were down in the 30s. So what you're doing is cooperating consistently with Congress, trying to maintain the privileges, the constitutional prerogatives that you can, but understanding that every day, Susan, that you're conceding authority. That you would, in a perfect world, would not concede. Indeed, Vice President Cheney, who was then the Republican whip in the House, commented to me while I was White House counsel. He bemoaned some of what he thought were the prerogatives of the White House that had been conceded while he was Chief of Staff during the Ford administration.
So there's been a little bit of a tradition, at least at the end of administrations, of bringing in kind of government investigation experts as White House counsels. The expectation that's, you know, you'll hit up against an investigation eventually. I guess the Obama administration may have sidestepped that one. We are only few months really into the Trump administration. If you were sort of advising on this issue, you know, should they be thinking the way White Houses are usually thinking, much further, sort of in their tenure, or would you advise bringing in someone who's sort of an expert in that role?
You always have to have that kind of capability on hand. Then when if disaster strikes, then you have to expand that capability. I was fortunate because I was on the receiving end of a lot of threats of lots of investigations when the Republicans took over the House in 2010. The incoming chairman of the Government Operations Committee, Darrell Issa, said he planned 62 different inquiries. He had not actually gotten along with many of them by the time I left. So I was fundamentally left, really, as my primary investigative challenge to prove in 2011 that President Obama was born in the United States, which I did by obtaining yet another copy of his birth certificate from the state of Hawaii. So I view that as a lawyering triumph of the first order. But you need that capability on hand. So when I came in, one of the first people that I recruited to the White House was the excellent, excellent lawyer who became my successor, Kathy Rumler, who both had litigation and white-collar defense experience and had worked in the Department of Justice.
Susan, the first thing I did, found out I was White House counsel. I was down in Mexico on vacation with four of my law school classmates and our wives, and Howard Baker called me up and told me I was the new White House counsel, that he had resigned my position with my law firm, and there was a military plane on its way to pick me up. So, I mean, true story.
You're lucky you got that call before the wall went up.
Yeah. Yep. But the first call I made was to a guy who became my deputy for the Iran-Contra investigation, who was a former counsel on the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigation, former AUSA in Chicago and in Philadelphia. And we built a separate staff of about 12 lawyers, including some people from your old home at NSA, military, DOD, CIA. Couldn't find paralegals, Bob, so I recruited archivists from the National Archivist with top secret clearances, because everything having to do with Iran-Contra was so highly classified that you needed to build a staff of people with SCI clearances, and that was a challenge. But yes, I mean, I think the ordinary job of White House counsel is so important, so all-encompassing, that the only way, I think, to deal with a special counsel investigation or a life-threatening congressional investigation is to build a separate staff.
So I think it's sort of uncontroversial to say that this is an unusual president, sort of an atypical president in terms of his instincts and impulsiveness. You look at Don McGahn, who's the current White House counsel. Is his job sort of resemble the jobs that either of you held at all, or does he have sort of a fundamentally different role? How does kind of the president's personality and the current environment change sort of what his work is?
I could think of, I know Don McGahn from the period of time before he went into the building, and I haven't discussed this with him. It's not a question I think I could appropriately ask, but I can think of three reasons why it would be fundamentally very different. First of all, I think it's fair to say, based on all the available public evidence, that Donald Trump's view of the law and the role of lawyers is different than my client's was. I'll start with that, and I think that's important. Secondly, I think the White House counsel really does benefit enormously from an acceptance of his or her role and a process-mindedness that supports the counsel in doing his or her job. The White House counsel cannot operate in a White House in which there are endless factions quarreling with each other. Some may be aligned with the White House counsel. Some may be suspicious of the White House counsel. And no predictable procedure for the raising and addressing of legal issues. Now, for all I know, that situation has changed since the chief of staff's position changed, since the person holding that office changed. But I can't imagine from the client to the apparent Wild West kind of character of the deliberative process that we understand to be the case in this current White House, I would imagine it'd be a very, very difficult job for the White House counsel to do.
As you might expect, I both agree and disagree with Bob. I think the legal issues that they're dealing with are pretty similar to those that most White House have dealt with. Separation of powers issues, constitutional authority issues, issues regarding statutory authority. The travel ban that Don McCann's dealing with, the executive orders, are some, you know, have the same legal issues in the main, I think, with the DACA issues that the Obama White House dealt with in the main. The issue, what is really different is, one, the president is the first to announce and often probably prematurely announces a lot of initiatives. So the White House loves to have communications discipline. You really don't have that all the time here. That's also part of the package. The package with President Trump. I vetted his vice presidential nominees. That was an interesting process. What was one of the more interesting things, and you see this doing in his presidency, he crowdsourced a lot of the process. He would go to a political rally and say, "Who should be my vice president?" And people would call out names, and then I would get a call that night. We'll add... add Susan Hennessy to the list.
You should have done that.
Yeah, I should have done that. I should have done that. I'm sorry. I just didn't think you were 35, Susan.
So if we sort of have Trump derangement syndrome on one end of the spectrum, and the other is, we've never seen a president like this ever. Everything is absolutely unprecedented. Abby, you've sort of described the legal issues as being largely the same. Maybe the president is a little bit different. Are we seeing novel rule of law issues, or are we really sort of, whenever you get down to the core of it, confronting things we've never seen before in terms of the legal issues we're looking at?
I would say yes. And I by the way, based on the last answer, I don't think that Abby and I disagree. I just think he's more diplomatic. The view I take of this presidency, and I try really hard, and I think if you have any institutional commitment at all that you would, to separate out, obviously, my politics, which are dramatically different from the president's. I take a look at two issues, for example, that I think set the tone for rule of law in this administration from the very beginning. One from the beginning and one more recently. The first was the way in which the president went about resolving his personal business conflicts. I think for a variety of reasons, which we may not have time to discuss, I think was wholly unsatisfactory. And I think it really leaves a stain on the institution and creates precedents that are extremely disturbing. And the second was the Arpaio pardon. Now, I can put a few in between, the firing of Jim Comey, the steady public humiliation of his attorney general until the Congress told him to stop. There are any number of things that we could talk about, you know, language directed toward the courts, critical language directed toward the courts. But I'll just take those two as having, I think, enduring institutional significance, the Emoluments Clause and the Arpaio pardon.
AB, do you disagree sort of in the main with Bob's point? Do you think we're addressing novel issues here, or that, you know, this is, it's a different flavor of the same things, you know, we've thought about separation of power, privilege, et cetera, for a long time?
I respectfully disagree with Bob.
I'm done.
No, I mean, on the ethics issues, I think it's quite clear that the conflict of interest statute don't apply to the president and the vice president. You know, that was intentional. That was, I think, Boyd and Gray was the who was also one of his predecessors and my successor was responsible for that. And so I, you know, the president didn't follow the precedent of other presidents, including the one I worked for. But that, to me, that's not a rule of law issue. That's a political issue. That's an issue that should be fought out in the political domain. And I, you know, we could get into the history of controversial pardons. I don't know all of the factors that went into that. Mrs. Reagan almost lynched me for recommending the pardon, you know, of George Steinbrenner. There were a number of people from your world who were recommending that. So I don't know all that went into to that pardon. But the pardoning power is absolute. It's unreviewable and for a reason. And again, I think the wisdom or the foolishness of that pardon, again, is a political decision. It'll be fought out in the political should be fought out in the political process.
So sort of digging back into some of the process and nitty-gritty of the role, what is the difference between a White House counsel and the president's personal attorneys? That's something that's sort of it's difficult to understand, especially in the midst of an investigation like this. How are those two different things?
In some instances, on some issues, I think AB may agree with this, and respectfully, I hope. On some issues, it may be that there is legal jeopardy that the president confronts, or legal issues that the president confronts in his personal capacity that overlap or touch upon or invade the sphere of official responsibility, so that there are institutional interests the White House counsel would be concerned with, and there are personal interests that the personal lawyer would be interested in. But that's the fundamental dividing line. The President of the United States retains, obviously, individual responsibility to comply with the law. And if the president has to defend, you know, some behavior that brings him within the investigative reach of law enforcement, then the president needs to have private counsel. And among other things, as you well know, during the Clinton era, this is a practical consideration, but I think the larger point would remain the same. The courts rejected an attempt on the part of President Clinton fundamentally to close those courts of communications with personal lawyers, of government lawyers with the president on those personal matters with attorney-client privilege. And I think that demonstrated the court's belief that the White House counsel is a government lawyer who, at the end of the day, as AB said earlier, represents the people of the United States, essentially. He represents the government of the United States and the president in his official capacity.
Lloyd Culler came to see me when I was early on in my tenure, Lloyd having been White House counsel to President Carter and then later for President Clinton. And Lloyd pointed out that to me that there is a statute which required me as an officer of the United States to report to the Attorney General the commission of any crime of which I became aware. So, I mean, if the president came in one day and said, I just committed tax fraud, right there I had an obligation to go make a report. So that is, and that is the basis upon which the D.C. Circuit and the Eighth Circuit decided that there was no institutional attorney-client privilege between the president and the White House counsel. Saying that, Ronald Reagan had no personal lawyer on the Iran-Contra investigation until after he left office. He decided that he had done nothing wrong, and he was not going to retain personal counsel, although he clearly had personal counsel for taxes and business affairs and that sort of thing.
How should we understand the role of someone like Ty Cobb, who is an employee of the White House and not a personal attorney, but is also not within the White House counsel's office and not doesn't report to McGahn? Is that sort of a traditional role? I can't quite think of a precedent for a lawyer that occupied that space. Is that so unusual, or is there a different way we should think about it in someone in that kind of role?
I did not have this experience, but I would imagine that if there is a major investigative challenge, consistent with what AB said about the importance of building separate operations to address that challenge, having a senior lawyer come in, both to manage that so the White House counsel can go on with his other duties, and also, frankly, to help coordinate the personal and professional side, because in this administration, for example, in Russia-related matters, there are clearly personal and institutional issues that are presented. And so having somebody who has his or her eye on those issues and attends to them and has that as their exclusive focus, it seems to me, is a sensible way of doing things. Now, one reads in the paper that Mr. Cobb has direct access to the president, and you know, there may be some questions of just how well coordinated the personal and professional, these two government lawyers are in their representation of this interest. That seems to me to be a potentially really dangerous problem. But we'll know more if we have lunch anywhere near the New York Times building.
My law office is in that building, but I did not overhear that lunch.
You didn't have your window open that day.
That's not an unusual role. When I came on board the Reagan White House, former Ambassador David Abshire and Charles Brower were already serving in a role of coordinating with the independent counsel just to make sure that all document requests were properly handled, that sort of thing. And Bill Litton, the fellow I described, stepped into that role. I think Lanny Davis, to a certain extent, in the Clinton White House, served that role. I mean, if you think of it this way, every day that a special counsel does not receive documents that he or she wants, every day that a witness stiff-arms them, some White House employee, it's a day where the president's political capital is being frittered away. Because the existence of these investigations erodes public confidence, they erode approval ratings, and so I think it's a very critical role that Ty Cobb is filling.
So sort of moving to the issue of special counsels, there's been a lot of public reports about sort of special counsel Mueller being particularly aggressive or moving quite quickly with respect to Paul Manafort or others. You know, as you're counseling a president in this sort of intensive investigation space, how does being confronted with something like a very aggressive special prosecutor sort of shade the advice or shade the job?
You let me get the softballs right. I've known Bob Mueller. He was the Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division when I was White House Counsel. I have immense respect for him. But he brings with him all of the dynamic flaws of a special counsel office that Justice Scalia and Morrison v. Olson described. If you set up an office of 17 high-powered, excellent, hard-nosed prosecutors to investigate a single matter and a small group of people, it is dangerous. It is something you need to pay attention to, one. Two, Bob Mueller and his office are in the fishbowl, too. And they're going to be second guess to a fare-thee-well of whether they investigated every facet of this that ought to be investigated. They're going to be second-guessed as to whether they've turned over every grain of sand, not whether they've turned over every rock and every pebble. So it really changes the dynamic. It is something that is also very difficult in a White House where you have the business of the most powerful nation in the world being conducted 24/7, trying to separate out the president seeking advice from people who don't have a privileged relationship with him, who are not his personal counsel, is very difficult to do. And you can, and apparently with with Bob Mueller wanting to see the records from Air Force One when the president apparently dictated a response relating to his son is an example of that. It's really hard to maintain the requisite discipline to keep the government business and the private business separate, as they should be.
So, Bob, you mentioned sort of obviously there wasn't a special prosecutor, but a really quite aggressive Congress that was really interested in investigating a lot of different topics. Is that so different than something like a special prosecutor? I mean, did you feel that that same dynamic was at play, or is this really something kind of different?
I think this is very different. My one experience with anything like what AB has described was the Starr investigation of President Clinton. In that circumstance, I didn't represent the executive branch. I represented the congressional leadership, represented Dick Gephardt in assembling the defense team in the House, and then I went to the Senate and represented the Senate Democratic majority during the impeachment trial. So my experience is from that side of it, but of course we could observe at close quarters, and I think many people could see around the country, the dynamic that AB describes here. There's an enormous amount of pressure on the executive branch. I can't find anything to disagree in what AB says about the challenges this must present to the lawyers.
The one important legal issue, Susan, is executive privilege. The executive privilege vis-a-vis a grand jury subpoena, we know from U.S. v. Nixon, does not trump. I mean, Jaworski got the tapes, right? In dicta in U.S. v. Nixon and in Senate Watergate Committee case in the D.C. Circuit, there's a very strong suggestion that the House Judiciary Committee sitting in impeachment trumps executive privilege. On the other hand, the Senate Watergate Committee, and I worked for Howard Baker on his Senate staff when he was vice chairman of the Senate Watergate Committee, lost its subpoena for the Watergate tapes. So you do have certain executive privilege gives the White House a defense that you don't have in the special counsel case or in the impeachment case.
I don't know whether you agree with this, AB, but I think it's interesting you mentioned the Watergate experience. I think the winds have really shifted against the executive. I think that's a political cultural change. I think it's very difficult to go before the court and basically have the executive argue that on a matter involving the production of evidence that may be relevant to a crime, that, you know, the privilege in effect trumps. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but I think it's just very, very difficult. It'll be interesting to see whether any of these issues are served up in the current administration.
So both of you, in some ways, had kind of easy clients in the sense that you both served under presidents who were, really quite disciplined and quite concerned about soliciting and accepting legal advice. Having any president as a client cannot be easy. They must all be sort of difficult clients in their own ways. Is the relationship we're seeing between Trump and McGahn or Trump and legal counsel, is it really so unusual? Or no, when you're the president of the United States and your lawyer says things that you don't agree with, you don't necessarily like, is there always sort of that tension? Did you guys have those moments of feeling like, God, being the lawyer's president is a really tough job?
I was very fortunate because the president that I served was a lawyer. Not only was he a lawyer, he was a constitutional law professor. So I didn't have to labor to translate the concerns that I had about the law in a language that he could understand. We often took pride, and this is just the way it just happened to work out this way. I'm not suggesting that every president of the United States has to be a lawyer, much less a constitutional law professor, but we took pride in being able to draft memoranda, say, about constitutional issues, and we wrote them the same way we would have written them for colleagues at the law firm or for the general counsel of a large corporation. We didn't have to go into an explanation of what it meant that there were different standards of review, rational basis versus strict scrutiny, all of that well known to the client. The other concern that I would have, and I have no way of knowing, obviously, just how far this concern reaches in fact, about the current relationship of a White House counsel to this kind of president. I'll say this kind for a reason. No government experience, none, zero. No institutional experience with sort of the processes and the systems on which the government runs in this country. And I think it's very difficult to take the experience that you've had with lawyers in the very different context in which President Trump has engaged with lawyers in the past, licensing, branding agreements, putting up buildings and the like in New York and elsewhere, and finding a way to adjust to what the role of the lawyer is within an institutional or governmental setting with which this president is completely unfamiliar. To me, that would be very difficult to do.
Did you have sort of a, Reagan obviously was not a constitutional law scholar, but you know, did have experience, had held elected office. I mean, did you feel like you were in that sort of translation role, or was he sort of more of an ordinary client?
Well, no, President Reagan's, I think, frustration with lawyers often found their roots in policy issues. I remember a law professor kept writing articles that there was an inherent line item veto buried in the presentment clause. And, of course, line item veto was a major policy initiative of the president, which we could never secure. Every time this professor, would publish yet another op-ed in the Wall Street Journal or someplace, I would round up every lawyer in the OLC, and we provide yet another explanation of why this law professor was wrong. On the big issues, the Iran-Contra issues, on why at the after Election Day but before George H.W. Bush was sworn in, we shouldn't pardon 15 people who had never gone through the process. He was a great client. He was a great client. He really was. President Reagan kept a daily journal, which has been published, but which I ultimately went through and read every page for production of things that were relevant to Iran-Contra. But I remember priding myself on what a great explanation I'd given him on the Castigar process and why I thought North and Poindexter would never, while their convictions, would be overturned. And whereupon I became later read his journal where he said, Culver House came in and briefed me on an issue relating to Colonel North and Admiral Poindexter. I really didn't understand what he had to say.
Before I open it up.
And I think even Bob would agree that Castigar is a pretty complicated legal doctrine.
I just wanted to bring that, I want to just briefly mention that you said, is it always difficult to represent a president? And of course, because if you're going to irritate a client, you don't want to irritate the President of the United States. But one of the things I want to say about staff support, which I said earlier, is imagine a situation where you go in and you're giving the client information that either in AB's case, the client doesn't understand or doesn't like. Not that the client's doubting your professionalism or the accuracy of your legal advice, but it's not welcome news, put it that way. And then you leave, and you have members of the staff coming in saying, Bauer's a jerk. You know, can we possibly think of finding somebody who knows where the word yes fits in the human lexicon? And if you have that, it's very, very difficult to do your job because it's already tough enough to be in a position where you're in the Oval Office giving advice and it's not sitting well with the principal.
So before we open it up to questions, I did promise that I would ask you both if, without violating privilege, you can share your craziest moment as White House counsel.
I don't know if this is a crazy moment, but it's one of my favorite moments. Bill Litton, my deputy for Iran-Contra, and I interviewed President Reagan 13 times for 3 hours a session on Iran-Contra, the arms sales, really walked him through all the chronologies. And in one of these sessions, it became clear to me that his recollection and the prior Tower Board investigation had been had supplanted his accurate recollection. In other words, he was someone else's memory had been implanted on his, and to the point where it was inconsistent with his own contemporaneous notes. And I was trying to explain to a client, which I think all of the lawyers in this room in the white collar context have had this occur to them, that it's okay to say I don't recall. It's okay to say, I no longer remember, particularly when the session that he was not accurately recalling was the day he was meeting with Secretary Gorbachev in Geneva. So whether or not he approved a hawk sale that day but in any event, it became very contentious. And Howard Baker, the White House Chief of Staff, came to me that night and said, you're going to have to apologize to him. he thought you were rude. He thought you leaned in too hard. And so I prepared my apology and went in the next day, prepared to apologize profusely. Ronald Reagan looked at me, smiled, and said, "Not guilty." I never had to apologize.
Susan, I've been rifling through my, you gave me some advance notice of this. I've been rifling through my mind, and I've gone from, I've tried to get to crazy. I've gone through, you know, slightly terrifying, totally disappointing, very frustrating, and totally privileged. So I don't know.
I will also ask you to join me in a round of applause for AB and Bob. This is great. Thank you so much.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare Podcast, share it on Facebook, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.